Well, greetings and welcome back once again to another of our devotional reflections on The Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan. Christian and Hopeful have been in the enchanted ground, and they've been naturally given to drowsiness because the ground is enchanted and a metaphor for spiritual lethargy. And so they stir one another to alertness by speaking of the things of God, and they speak of Hopeful's testimony. They have a conversation with Ignorance, who misses the gospel, and they speak of the one temporary whose faith was temporary, who typifies the apostate and shows the need for pressing on all the way into heaven. But now they come into the country of Beulah. Bunyan says, "Now I saw in my dream, by this time the pilgrims were got over the enchanted ground and entering into the country of Beulah, whose air was very sweet and pleasant." And Beulah is the Hebrew word that means merry. And it comes from Isaiah chapter 62, where God is speaking of marrying Israel sort of once again after all their troubles, as they come to the eschaton, as they come to the last things, and God restores the nation. And in Isaiah 62:2, it says, "The nations will see your righteousness, kings your glory. You'll be called by a new name, which the mouth of the Lord will designate. You'll also be a crown of beauty in the hand of the Lord, and a royal diadem in the hand of God." Verse 4, Isaiah 62:4, "It will no longer be said to you, forsaken, nor to your land will it any longer be said, desolate, but you will be called, my delight is in her, and your land married." And the land married is Beulah. "For Yahweh delights in you, and to him your land will be married." And so what Bunyan is doing is he's taking the promise to Israel and the restoration of the nation in that latter day, and he's figuratively applying it to all believers' experience of heaven. We will no longer be, quote-unquote, forsaken, that is, without our husband, but as the bride, we will be united to our bridegroom, and he will call us married. And so this is the land of Beulah, whose air was very sweet and pleasant, the way lying directly through it. They solaced themselves there for a season. And there they heard continually the singing of birds, and saw every day the flowers appear in the earth, and they heard the voice of the turtle dove in the land. And this is the language of Song of Solomon, chapter 2, verses 10 to 12, which, of course, is that description of marriage, the description of marriage between the husband and the wife. Well, the Puritans were convinced that Song of Solomon was not merely a treatise on marriage, but that it pictured figuratively the marriage between Christ and his people, so that the church was the bride and Christ was the bridegroom. And so he's using the language of marriage here in a number of ways to say that the reuniting of these two pilgrims with Christ the bridegroom is coming soon. They're in the land of their remarriage. "Wherefore this was beyond," it says, "in this country the sun shineth night and day. Wherefore this was beyond the valley of the shadow of death, and also out of the reach of giant despair. Neither could they from this place so much as see Doubting Castle. Here they were within sight of the city they were going to." And so all of the troubles of the world, though they're not out of the world yet, they're at a place where the despair of the valley of the shadow of death, the despair of the castle of Doubting Castle and giant despair, that's all a thing of the past. And it says, "For in this land, there the shining ones commonly walked. Angels commonly walked around in this land because this land was so close to death, so close to the celestial city, because it was on the borders of heaven. In this land also the contract between the bride and the bridegroom was renewed. Yea, here as the bridegroom rejoiceth over the bride, so did their God rejoice over them." That's Isaiah 62:5, the next verse in that marriage scene. "And here they had no want of corn and wine, for in this place they met with abundance of what they had sought in all their pilgrimage," which is 62:8. "I'll never again give your grain as food for your enemies," and so on. "Here they heard voices from out of the city, loud voices saying, say to the daughter of Zion, behold, thy salvation cometh. Behold, his reward is with him. Here all the inhabitants of the country called them the holy people and the redeemed of the Lord sought out," and so on. So this is Isaiah 62, again, verse 11, verse 12, that here is the land of the marriage of the people of God to their bridegroom Christ. Now, as they walked in this land, they had more rejoicing than in parts more remote from the kingdom to which they were bound. And drawing near to the city, they had yet a more perfect view thereof. As you get closer and closer to heaven, the clearer the glories of heaven appear to you. It was builded of pearls and precious stones. Also the streets thereof were paved with gold, so that by reason of the natural glory of the city and the reflection of the sunbeams upon it, Christian with desire fell sick. Hopeful also had a fit or two of the same disease. Wherefore here they lay by it a while, crying out because of their pangs, "If you see my beloved, tell him that I am sick of love." He's saying they see how glorious heaven is. And in the imagery of the Song of Solomon, where the bride is the church and Christ is the bridegroom, they're saying, the glory of heaven is so glorious that I'm lovesick, that I'm fainting for lovesick fits, that I just can't take it in. I can't believe how glorious this is. But then, being a little strengthened and better able to bear their sickness, they walked on their way and came yet nearer and nearer, where were orchards, vineyards, and gardens, and their gates opened into the highway. You know, language of the Garden of God, the return to Eden, you know, back to the Tree of Life, the dainties that refresh and nourish the children of God. And then there's the gardener, and the pilgrims ask, "Whose goodly vineyards and gardens are these?" And he says, "They're the king's, and are planted here for his own delight, and also for the solace of pilgrims." I'm in the garden that Jesus planted, that he planted for his own enjoyment. How cool is that? That this, what Jesus made for his own delight, I get to be a sojourner in. And he also made it for the rest and solace of pilgrims. And so the gardener had them into the vineyards and bid them refresh themselves with dainties. And he showed them there the king's walks and arbors, where the king delighted to be. So here, look, this, when the king is here, here's where he walks. How glorious to know the ways of Christ this way. And so here they tarried and slept. Now I beheld in my dream that they talked more in their sleep at this time than they ever did in all their journey. They just are just talking in their sleep from how their imaginations are running away with them with the anticipation of heaven. Well, eventually they awake and they address themselves to go up to the city. But as Bunyan said, the reflection of the sun upon the city, for the city was pure gold, the reflection was so extremely glorious that they couldn't yet with open face behold it, but through an instrument made for that purpose. They couldn't see the glory of heaven even still yet, aside from the instruments, aside from the scriptures. Remember, on the Delectable Mountains, the shepherds give them a looking glass, a telescope to see the city of heaven from afar off, and they can barely see because they're still fearful of the pangs of hell that they hear nearby. Well, they look through, they say, "We can sort of see it." Well, through scriptures, we see the glories of heaven more and more clearly. And so what they can't behold with their naked eye, they can behold through the scriptures. The shining ones asked them where they came from, and they told them, they asked them where they had lodged and what difficulties and dangers. And so Christian and Hopeful are telling them their testimony once again. And the angels, the shining ones, tell them that you've got two more difficulties to meet with. Christian and his companion ask the men to go with them. "Okay, well, if we've got danger, will you please come with us?" And they agreed, but they said, "You must obtain the city by your own faith. We can't believe you into it. We can't believe for you. We can't carry you over there. You've got to obtain it by yourself. There are no sacraments that are going to get you over. There is no priest that is going to wave a wand or sprinkle some water and say, all right, you're saved. You have to have saving faith of yourself, which is to say granted to you by God as a gift from him. It still has to be your believing. You can't get over into heaven because your father or mother believed. You can't get over into believing because you were baptized or confirmed. You have to take possession of the city by faith alone. Now, I further saw that between them and the gate was a river." So now they can see the gate, but in front of their path is a river. And it says there was no bridge to go over, and the river was very deep, so you can't just walk through it. At the sight, therefore, of this river, the pilgrims were much astounded. But the men that went with them said, "You must go through, or you cannot come to the gate." This river is the river of death. Every one of us who would go to heaven has to die. We can't, except for, and he'll say it in a moment, except for Enoch and Elijah, who were taken up by God supernaturally, everyone who would come into the possession of the celestial city has to get there by dying. We have to cross this river. It just flows from one end to the other. You can't go around it. It's not like you can just walk through it easily. You got to go through it, or you can't go to the celestial city. The pilgrims then began to inquire if there was no other way to the gate, to which they answered, well, yes, but there has not any save two, Enoch and Elijah, been permitted to tread that path since the foundation of the world, nor shall there be until the last trumpet sound. At the rapture, when the last trumpet sounds, everybody's not going to die, but they'll all be changed, right? Fear 1 Corinthians 15. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed in the twinkling of an eye. Those alive on the earth when the Lord comes will not experience death. But aside from them and Elijah and Enoch, everybody's got to die. And the pilgrims ask, can there be any other way? And this shows that even for Christians, we understand that death brings us heaven, but the process of dying is still a fearful thing. It's still a natural thing to be fearful of dying. Not fearful of death, because you're confident where death will bring you, but the manner in which you die, I mean, pain, difficult, the way the cancer ravages a body, the way that, you know, old age, Alzheimer's, dementia, congestive heart failure, having to go in any sort of less natural way is difficult. And so it's not wrong for a Christian to desire not to face dying. Now, the pilgrims then, and especially Christian, began to despond in his mind. And you remember that Christian is especially given to the besetting sin of despondency, of depression, that he had to go through the slough of despond that faithful didn't have to go through, that he had to go through the valley of humiliation and then the valley of the shadow of death. And then he was the one when they were in the castle of doubting castle of giant despair that was swooning and just thinking we ought to kill ourselves. And hopeful is telling him, no, brother, don't do it. Press on. And that eventually he found the keys of the promises in his bosom to let them out. Christian's besetting sin, Bunyan's besetting sin, I think, was just being given to fits of despondency and despair, of the loss of assurance of salvation. And so here, when he faces the fearfulness of the river of death, he begins to despond again. And this is the case with many Christians who are stalwarts in their faith and courage. But when it comes to death, they really realize what their faith is worth. Do I really believe what I say, that this is the end, that is only the beginning, that it brings me to Christ, that it's better to depart and be with Christ, that absent from the body is present with the Lord? Do I believe all that? Doubts especially come and creep in this last moment. And we think, oh, what if I was wrong? What if it was some other religion? Or what if it was no religion at all? What if this is all a fairy tale? What if the Bible is just written by men? What if this is just one big way to control people? And I bought into it. And you start to fear death. And there are ways that you're going to have to prepare yourself for that battle, that final test of faith. Well, they said, well, how can we escape the river? And then they asked the men of the waters. They said, are they all of a depth? Are they all the same depth here? And they actually say, no, they could not, like, we can't help you in this case, right? We can't get you out of death, but you're going to find the waters deeper or shallower as you believe in the king of the place. Death will be more of a trial of faith, more scary, more alarming and discouraging to you the lower your faith is. And the stronger your faith, the easier death will seem. If your faith is weak, there's going to feel like there's no bottom. And you're just waiting and you're trying to get your nose and your mouth above the water so you can just catch some air. And you're going to think that the waves are coming over you and you're a goner. But the stronger your faith is, the more death, though unwelcome and uncomfortable and painful even, you're going to feel like, oh, my feet can touch the bottom and I can get through this. This is not easy, but I'm going to push forward. The current is strong, but I can feel something firm under my feet. The more you believe, the shallower it'll feel. The less you believe, the deeper it'll feel. Then they addressed themselves to the water, so they went into the river of death. And Christian began to sink, and crying out to his good friend Hopeful, he said, "I sink in deep waters. The billows go over my head, all the waves go over me," from the Psalms. Then said the other, "Be of good cheer, my brother, I feel the bottom, and it is good." And then said Christian, "Ah, my friend, the sorrows of death have encompassed me about. I shall not see the land that flows with milk and honey." And with that, a great darkness and horror fell upon Christian so that he couldn't even see before him. Also here, he in a great measure lost his senses so that he could neither remember nor orderly talk of any of those sweet refreshments that he had met with in the way of his pilgrimage. You come to the moment of death and you're despairing and you start to forget every evidence of grace that you've ever experienced in your life. All these things that would say, of course I'm a child of God. Of course I'm a true follower of Jesus. Look at all the way I wouldn't have done this unless it was by his grace. I wouldn't have accomplished this unless he was the one working it in me. It couldn't have been my native strength that did all these things, that left off sin, that joy to read the scriptures, that delighted in the fellowship of the saints. But in the moment of death, you don't think of those things because you're fearful, because your faith is being tried. But all the words that he spake still tended to discover that he had horror of mind and heart fears that he should die in that river and never obtain entrance at the gate. This is it. Death is all that there is. There's no heaven for me. I'm lost. Here also, as they that stood by perceived, he was much in the troublesome thoughts of the sins that he had committed. See, that's, you don't remember the evidence of grace. You remember the evidence of your flesh. You remember the evidence of sin still at work in your life. And you torment yourself with all these thoughts. Could I really have been saved and committed all these sins? Could I really have been saved and not gained victory over this corruption, this lust? So it's also observed that he was troubled with apparitions of hobgoblins and evil spirits. So he's demonic torment. Forever and anon he would intimate so much by words. Hopeful, therefore, had much ado to keep his brother's head above water. And it actually says Hopeful comes and grabs him and holds him up, which is just a glorious picture of you know, how it can be for two to die together, for two to be together in old age and to comfort one another with the thoughts and the fears of dying without Christ. You know, holding one's head above the water so you can breathe, as it were. And Hopeful says, "Brother, I see the gate. There are men standing there to receive us." And Christian says, "No, they're only waiting for you. For me, I'm lost." "Oh, brother," he said, "surely if I was right, he would now rise to help me, but he's left me." Hopeful says, "Brother, you have quite forgot the text where it is said of the wicked, there is no bands in their death, but their strength is firm. They are not troubled as other men, neither are they plagued like other men. These troubles and distresses that you go through in these waters are no sign that God has forsaken you, but are sent to try you whether you will call to mind that which heretofore you have received of his goodness and live upon him in your distress." Brothers and sisters, are you ready to die? Are you ready to face the trial of death? I don't mean are you ready to die like are you sure heaven is certain for you. I mean, are you ready to engage in the process of dying where your faith will be so tested that you're liable to forget every good thing that God has worked in you and remember every bad thing you've ever done? We have to prepare for this trial of death always so that when we come to it, our faith won't fail, that our faith will remember that God has been good to us, that our faith will remember that his grace has worked in us and has saved us, and we've known sweet and intimate communion with him, and that we've seen the fruit of the Spirit produced by grace in our lives. And so that when Satan comes and tries to tempt us, like Christian is experiencing, I can't really be a Christian, we'll be able to fight it off and cross that river with greater ease than we otherwise might. Then I saw in my dream that Christian was as in a muse a while, to whom Hopeful added these words, "Be of good cheer, Jesus Christ makes thee whole." And with that, Christian broke out with a loud voice, "Oh, I see him again. And he tells me, when thou passest through the waters, I will be with thee, and through the rivers they shall not overflow thee." Isaiah 43, verse 2. It's worth reading in the familiar text to us, as the King James might not be as familiar, but Isaiah 43, 2. "When you shall pass through the waters, I will be with you, and through the rivers they will not overflow you. When you walk through the fire, you will not be scorched, nor will the flame burn you, for I am Yahweh your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Savior." How glorious is that Christ would come in that moment of great despair and minister consolation to the soul. And then they both took courage, and the enemy was after that as still a stone until they were gone over. Christian, therefore, presently found ground to stand upon, and so he finally got his footing. And so it followed that the rest of the river was but shallow. He recovered his faith. His faith was recovered for him by Christ. And then he found the ground of the river more shallow until he got over. Thus they got over. And so Christian and Hopeful died. They passed through the river. They went through the turmoil and tumult of death, and they got over to the gate of the celestial city. And we'll see them at that gate next time.